Explaining Michael Howell's Liquidity Framework. Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. 2 weeks ago, we had on Michael Howell of Cross Border Capital. Now, Michael broke down his views on liquidity, his outlook, and a lot of individual global macroeconomic topics, including the currency war going on in Asia. Now, you at home requested that I break down some of his analysis even more to help you guys understand some of the things that are a little bit more complicated that he might be discussing. So, as your teacher, that is my goal today. So, let's get right into it. Okay, Michael Howell in this episode starts with his view on liquidity utilizing his Global Liquidity Index. Now, this Global Liquidity Index is Cross-Border Capital's holy grail. What is it and what does it consist of? Now, we're going to be very honest with you guys. We see Michael Howell's work that he's put in over the last several decades, and we understand that his framework has a lot of merit. That's why we've had him on multiple times, and that's why we try to understand his framework. Okay, now first things first, I want you guys to go check out this book, Capital Wars, okay? This is Michael Howell's whole framework and his thesis, really. And so it is important. I would recommend people to go into it. Now, as I have gone through Howell's book, it is extremely complicated. I find myself reading the same 3 to 5 pages, maybe even a dozen times, with a pen, with my own notebook, trying to break it down. And that is me as a student trying to do my best there. So today, I'm going to do my best to save you the time of going through his book and just try to simplify it as much as possible. Okay, so what is his liquidity index? What does it measure? The Bitcoin Layer is very proud to be sponsored by River, a Bitcoin-only exchange and who we believe to be the leader in the business. Go check them out today at river.com/TBL for a special offer of up to $100 of Bitcoin for free when you go sign up. You have a lot of options when it comes to buying Bitcoin. We believe River is your best choice because they do not custody your Bitcoin on a third-party exchange. They have their own solution for storage, and they encourage you to get your coins off the exchange as soon as possible. River.com/TBL for that special offer. Michael Howell's framework is all about the flow of funds. So when he refers to liquidity, it's not in the same way that you might think of liquidity in terms of a certain asset being very liquid and having a high degree of liquidity. So when we think about Bitcoin's liquidity, we are talking about how much money can move in and out of Bitcoin without moving the price too much. If it can, then Bitcoin would be thought of as very liquid or have a lot of liquidity. U.S. Treasuries, the liquidity around U.S. Treasuries is something that's often discussed. So as one of the major asset classes across the entire spectrum, right, it is the foundational interest rate within the U.S. dollar spectrum, this U.S. Treasury curve. So there's a high degree of liquidity in the instrument, especially when we get into treasury futures. But when we think about the treasury market individually, each treasury security would theoretically have a different amount of liquidity. Why? Because each treasury security was issued at a different time. So the treasury, the 10-year treasuries that were issued this month are a different security than the ones that were issued 3 months ago, for example. So each treasury security out there has its own liquidity challenges with the backdrop of the whole asset class having a high degree of liquidity because they are U.S. treasury securities and there's a large quantity of them. So liquidity for securities and liquidity for asset classes in terms of money being able to move in and out very quickly without moving the price too much. That is a definition of liquidity that you and I are all used to. And when we hear the word liquidity quoted in the financial media, we're actually hearing people refer to how much money is in that particular asset class and how easily it can move in and out. Therefore, liquidity also has to do with the trading volume behind each instrument. If there are a lot of traders and if there's a lot of capital involved in a particular instrument, then it would be thought to have a high degree of liquidity. So now with that definition of liquidity, which hopefully after hearing that explanation, hopefully you guys hear that and say, yes, that is what I understood to be liquidity or how the financial media uses that word. Now I want you to throw all of that out the window for the next however many minutes this video goes. And our goal here is to use liquidity on a blank slate. We're going to scrap your previous understandings of the word. We're going to give it a new meaning today. And that's what Hal does in his book. He goes through, I understand this is how you think of liquidity, but forget that. Let's break down this new way to think about this word and what it means to me. Okay, we're starting with a fresh blank slate on the word liquidity. What does this word mean? Michael Howell takes this framework from his days at Salomon Brothers and Henry Kaufman. Kaufman put forth this theory that what powers asset prices is the quantity of funds that flow through the system. Now, this concept of flow of funds and quantity of funds is what they define as liquidity. So liquidity is not then how much money can go in and out of a particular asset class, but it's actually how much money is there in the world. That's the way that they're thinking about liquidity, okay? So let me say that again in a maybe in a different way. Liquidity to Michael Howell is the sheer amount of money that has the ability to move through the system. And so how can we measure the amount of money that can move through the system? It really comes back to one core metric, and that is the size of the balance sheets throughout the financial system. So Michael Howell's framework includes cross-border capital flows. So that's in the name. I asked him about that. We'll get to that a little bit later in this video when we get to that part of the interview. But let's focus on this first concept here, which is the size of the balance sheets of the financial institutions throughout the system. So this includes central banks and commercial banks. And that's a very important distinction, because when we hear people talk about the money supply, a lot of times they're talking about the quantity of money that has been issued by the central banking system across the world, and not including necessarily the commercial banking system. So this concept of liquidity is pinned on both the assets of commercial banks and central banks. Notably about Howell's liquidity index is that it's global. So it's not just the US and the US dollar, the Fed, and American banks. It is all banks around the world and all central banks, including China. Now, China is an enormous contributor to global money supply and therefore global liquidity. So when you hear global money supply, and it includes central bank money and commercial bank money, that would be a quantity of money that would be more akin to Michael Howell's Global Liquidity Index. Now, right now, the index sits at somewhere around $175 trillion. So you guys should know at home that what we're doing at the Bitcoin Layer is, while we're conducting our own research and trying to go through Hal's framework, teach ourselves, and learn what he is talking about. Now, even though I'm trying to reverse engineer his index, I haven't tried that much because, admittedly, there are several components to this index that, just mathematically speaking, I don't have down yet. And so I'm trying to go one step at a time. So the size of central bank balance sheets and commercial bank balance sheets, not just the total size, but the quantity of securities that they own that can be converted instantly to cash. And that is why he calls it liquidity. Okay, so let's say that again. We have an asset base across the system. So imagine the Fed owns treasuries, right? The Fed owns treasuries and the commercial banking system also owns treasuries. Now, add that up in the United States and across the rest of the world. That also includes the European debt that's owned by the ECB and the European banking system. So German banks owning German bunds, French banks owning French government bonds, the ECB owning German bunds and French government bonds. It includes China, the People's Bank of China, and the government securities that they own, and the government securities that are owned by the banking system in China as well. And so at its very minimum, this index includes all of that capital. Now, note how it's not just measuring the quantity of sovereign debt in the system, because a lot of that sovereign debt is owned by whom? It's owned by the investing public. It's not owned by the banking system that uses those bonds as collateral. And that is another key word here in Michael Howe's liquidity framework. You'll hear the both of us use the word collateral throughout the conversation. What we are referring to are those government bonds, but not all of them. The ones that are owned by the banking system. And that's why they are collateral, because they are used by the banking system to transform that collateral into cash. And that is what we call the repo market. So let's pause Michael Howe's liquidity framework explanation for a quick explanation on the repo market. The repo market really underpins a lot of this idea of global liquidity index being the collateral that's in the system, because through the repo market, the collateral can become cash. And I promise I'm going to get back to why it's called liquidity here in a few moments, okay? So let's first talk about the repo market. The repo market is the transformation of collateral into cash. That is the way to think of it. If you think about a pawn shop on the corner that will transform your gold jewelry into US dollar notes, Federal Reserve notes, paper money, okay? That is transformation of collateral into cash. I have gold in my hand, I go to the store, and I walk out with paper money. I've just transformed a piece of jewelry into paper money. That pawn shop is the perfect metaphor for the repo market, okay? You go to the repo market, and what do you have? You don't have a gold chain. You have a treasury bond, a treasury note, a treasury bill. A bill just means a zero coupon security that's issued with a 1 year or less maturity. So 1 month, 3 month, 6 month bills, for example. Notes are the colloquial term for twos, threes, fives, sevens, and tens. And then the 30-year part of the curve is called the bond. And that's just a colloquial difference between the 30-year part of the curve and the front end part of the curve. But the whole 2 through 30s, and I shouldn't forget the 20-year part of the curve as well, because that's now back issued in, it's issued in the Treasury primary market as well. All of those from 2 to 30 are semi-annual coupon securities, okay? So they pay twice a year the coupon, and they pay par at the end of the maturity. Now, we can take this treasury security to the repo market and transform it into cash. And so that is what the repo market is. If I have a treasury bond, I can take it to the repo market, and the repo market will turn that collateral and lend me essentially 97% of the value of that collateral. And in this way, a bank, and forget the word central for a second, let's just include central banks in this term banking now. If a bank owns a treasury security, it can very easily transform that treasury collateral into 97% cash. And what can it do with that cash? And this is now back to the word liquidity, okay? So I've given you the repo 101. It's the pawn shop for treasury bonds or treasury collateral. And we are the banking system now. We have the treasury collateral. We own it. It's our asset. We can transform it into cash and then do what with it? Spend it. That's where the word liquidity comes from, because that money can be spent on what? Other financial assets, including corporate bonds and equities. And so that is why Michael Howell's Global Liquidity Index is so well correlated with the prices of assets. It's because if you think about the quantity of collateral that's owned by the banking system, that collateral can directly be transformed into spendable money. And that money doesn't get spent at the grocery store or at the pump. It doesn't even necessarily get spent in the sovereign oil market, okay? It gets spent in the financial sphere. That is why asset prices move with Michael Howell's Global Liquidity Index. So it's a study that he's done based on decades of work and decades of empirical evidence that the quantity of collateral in the system moves the needle. So it's not just the quantity of sovereign debt that's owned by the banking system. That is a major, major component here. Now, we don't have the individual contributors to Michael Howell's Liquidity Index. And like I told you guys, although we are in theory trying to reverse engineer it, really all we're trying to do is learn it one component at a time. And so in our conversation, you'll hear me ask Michael Howell about T-bill monetization. So let's get into that portion of the conversation. So let's talk about T-bill monetization, and then we'll get back to Michael Howell's Global Liquidity Index and directionally where it's been and where it's going and why, okay? But before we explain that, we have to explain T-bill monetization and my question about that. Now, today, I'm not going to go really deeply or much at all into the Chinese banking system and the driver of global liquidity that is new Chinese money. Okay, China's banking system and how liquidity is created over there is way outside of my area of expertise. So I'd rather take much more time getting into that, trying to research it myself and explaining it and really just asking more questions there and doing more research. But I can explain to you the US side of things. So that's where I will remain here today. So T-bill monetization by the commercial banking sector, what does that mean? Well, the reason that I make the distinction with commercial banking is that you might be familiar with QE being the purchase of treasury securities by the Fed, and the Fed issues reserves to the banking system. So it's an asset swap for the commercial banking system. The commercial banking system loses treasuries and gains reserves. But at the central banking level, we have an expansion of the money supply because you have a digital creation of reserve balances to purchase those treasury securities. So that's what QE is. But what is T-bill monetization by commercial banks? Mechanically, this is how it works. The treasuries get issued at auction. They end up with the buy side, meaning asset managers or foreign direct buyers, sovereign wealth funds, foreign governments, foreign central banks, U.S. commercial banks. So we have some buyers there, but then we have these dealers that take down inventory. Those dealers then will sell that inventory on to commercial banks. Now, I said commercial banks already. Commercial banks show up at the auction and they will swap reserves for treasuries, and that is not a direct monetization because those reserves were already in the system. So again, that was an asset swap for the commercial bank. But the commercial bank will also add treasuries after the fact in the open market. And when it does that, it can monetize the debt. And in that way, the way that that happens is that the primary dealers take down excess inventory at treasury auctions. They put up that inventory for sale. A commercial bank sees it and says, okay, I will take down some of that inventory. And when the bank takes down that inventory, it can create a deposit for the primary dealer and therefore absorb the T-bill, creating a deposit or even a repo liability to whoever lent the money from somewhere else in the banking system. Money gets created when T-bills are purchased by commercial banks in the secondary market. So in this way, commercial banks can expand their balance sheet, add treasuries on the asset side, and then add a deposit for whichever primary dealer they purchase that inventory from. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be a primary dealer. It can be a treasury that is elsewhere in the system that has already settled, that now can be swapped out for a deposit for the seller. So the seller has a treasury and now gets a deposit. And the commercial bank absorbs a treasury and issues a deposit. And now, remember, when I say the word issued a deposit, issued means created. So that is why the commercial banking system can create money for T-bills, and that is what Mike Howell is calling monetization. And let me explain something to you too. People will bicker with him about why he calls it monetization, and they will say it's the wrong word to call it. Don't call it that. And they have bickered with him and they will continue to. Ignore all of it. What Michael Howell's point is that the banking system expands. It expands when this happens. It doesn't happen for every treasury that is issued, but it's happening for a lot of them. And so when that action happens, a commercial bank buys a T-bill in the secondary market and creates a deposit, issues a deposit, what grows in size? The Michael Howell Global Liquidity Index grows in size. And so what grows? Liquidity, per his definition, liquidity grows. So when he talks about T-bill monetization, he's talking about commercial banks expanding their balance sheets and thereby creating more liquidity in the system to then swap that treasury for cash to spend on financial assets. Now, one more concept before we move on here on bills themselves. We talk a lot about T-bills here in this conversation. Why do we talk a lot about T-bills? Because T-bills are the plug for the federal government. What do I mean by that? The government can only issue X amount of long-term debt. Because if it issues 2X that amount, it might really affect the price. What does that mean? The Treasury right now is issuing $70 billion worth of five-year notes. Okay, every month. The Treasury issued $70 billion of five-year notes. It, when it issues those $70 billion, it is telling the market way in advance how much it is going to issue in each part of the curve. Now, even though Treasury will update its estimates every quarter for how much it's going to issue, it forecasts 1 to 2 years out as well how much it's going to need to issue. Now, the market understands that we are going to see higher coupon auctions in the future, meaning non-bills. We know we're going to see that increase, but we know it's going to be slow and steady. We also know it's not going to double next month. It's not going to double next quarter. It's not even going to double next year. But it might go up a lot, but it can't go up so fast that it actually wrecks the market. And that is when you might see Treasury yields just go absolutely haywire out the curve if the Treasury is going to start issuing way more supply. So this is actually a concept we've talked about with a few of our guests of late. It has to do with term premia. We close with this concept with Michael Howell in this conversation as well. This is the concept of the term premia. Now, instead of explaining term premia, just think of it as the yield curve for a second. The yield curve is the term structure of interest rates. So it's the interest rate at each individual term. So the 10-year term has its own interest rate. The 30-year term has its own interest rate. So does the three-month part of the curve or the two-year part of the curve. So when we talk about the yield curve, we're picking 2 points on the curve and measuring the slope. Is the longer term higher yielding than the shorter term? Right now, it's not. The 10-year yield is lower than the two-year yield. And the reason people suggest for this inverted curve is that the Treasury hasn't issued as many longer-term securities as they could have. So they're artificially keeping the longer-term securities scarce. And if there's artificial scarcity, that will boost the price. And remember, in fixed income, prices going up means yields going down. So a higher price for Treasury securities means a lower yield. So a lower yield in Treasuries in, let's say, the 10 part of the curve than in the front end of the curve, some people suggest that that is evidence the Treasury is keeping an artificial scarcity on longer-term issuance. Instead of arguing whether I agree with that or not, and it really is a it's both, there's arguments on both sides, and I can make a very strong argument on both sides, but we'll save that for another day, why the curve is inverted and whether or not there is artificial scarcity. The point here is that supply is what we can measure. So if supply will not be doubled and tripled in five-year notes and in 30-year bonds, how will the Treasury Department raise money for all this obscene spending, fiscal deficit spending that it's doing to the tune of $1 to $2 trillion per year? We know that there have been $10 trillion in cumulative deficits over the last 5 years. That money gets funded with T-bills, okay? The short end of the curve, these short-term instruments, that's how the Treasury funds the gap the gap in the budget, which is the deficit. So the deficit spending is done by issuing T-bills. So when that's why Hal fixates on T-bills and them getting monetized, because that is the plug. That's where the quantity really is, okay? The quantity of T-bills has really gone up a lot. Now, back to why he focuses so much on T-bills and the question that I ask him, that he responds to, that I have my understanding of it correctly. So why does this huge T-bill issuance affect liquidity? From the one side of things, it's the collateral stock. So the size of collateral in the system. When commercial banks monetize these T-bills, it means they're issuing fresh money to do so. And in this way, T-bill issuance really grows the banking system. Because those same treasuries, if they were longer term bonds, they might not have necessarily been purchased by commercial banks. They might have gone to investors. Okay? And if there were, and the reason that investors are not taking down those T-bills is it's not attractive enough for them to do so right now. If the yields were higher on 10 and 30 year notes and bonds, maybe those investors would take down that those securities. So that's one side of it. The size of collateral in the system grows when T-bills get issued. But then what is another side of it, right? And then the second thing here is that you don't have the duration hit to the market. What do we mean by that? So think about what I just said about the artificial scarcity. So if you have more bills, you don't have more bonds. And if you don't have more bonds, that is what? The artificial scarcity that I was talking about. So again, whether or not the artificial scarcity is the thing itself causing the inversion of the curve is not important. The point here is that you have artificial scarcity. So if you had bonds being issued instead of bills, bond yields would go up and collateral prices would go down. Because remember, in fixed income, prices and yields are inverse. So as yields go up, prices go down. So if bonds were issued, if the Treasury decided we're going to issue a lot of bonds instead of bills, we're going to issue a lot of bonds, what does that do? It tells investors, oh, we are going to demand a higher yield then. We're going to demand a higher yield. So the price of all the existing debt goes down. What does that do to Michael Howe's definition of liquidity? It reduces the ability for the banks to turn collateral into cash because the prices have gone down. Now, they're not going down by 50%. They're going down by a few percent. But every little cent matters, especially when we're talking about $100 trillion of collateral. That is a lot of money then that can disappear from the system. And that's, again, why liquidity, when it goes down, asset prices go down. So when you think about yields moving markets, think about Michael Howe's liquidity framework and the collateral component of it. If treasury yields go up, it means treasury prices go down. If treasury prices go down, the asset size of the banking system goes down. The ability for the banking system to turn collateral into cash to buy financial assets goes down. So stock prices go down. That's how it works. And that's why you have to understand that yields affect asset prices across the board. And of course, treasury prices can go up in a risk-off move as risky assets go down in price. So higher treasury yields can cause weak asset prices, but also very weak asset prices can be caused by a weak economy, which cause higher treasury prices. So it's not just linear. I always tell my team that. I always write about this concept. Make sure you guys go sign up for our free research letter at thebitcoinlayer.com/subscribe. We write about these concepts so that you guys understand it's not linear. We can't just say A is happening, so then B will happen. There's many things happening all at the same time. But yes, collateral prices moving lower as yields go up affects global liquidity in Michael Howe's index. Quantitatively affects the index and therefore drives asset prices lower. Or I shouldn't say therefore, I should say historically or empirically, it has lined up well with asset price declines. Again, collateral prices are only one component of the framework. We don't have the metric as to how much it is in the contribution to his index, but my goal is to explain to you guys my understanding as I go. And so if I can I can well articulate this issue to you on collateral prices being one of the main components of his liquidity framework, that's what we're going to start with. And then who knows, maybe we'll do several more episodes like this where we just keep going deeper and deeper into the concepts. I can already tell you that when we get to the duration portion, that is a very thick concept that probably needs a whole episode in itself and maybe even an entire interview with Michael Howell himself. So now let's close with a couple last concepts here. We'll talk about duration and then we'll go back to the index and his outlook. On duration, what is duration? Duration is the sensitivity of an asset, a fixed income asset, to movements in interest rates. So if a bond has duration, that means that as interest rates change, the price of that bond will change. So as interest rates rise, prices fall, but they fall by more if a particular fixed income instrument has a very long term to maturity. And in that long term to maturity, you have several cash flows and many years of discounting of those cash flows. So that bond has a lot of sensitivity, price sensitivity to changes in interest rates. As interest rates go up, the price of a 30-year bond will fall materially. Okay, so what Michael Howell is talking about with duration is that the duration of treasuries in the system, the collateral in the system itself, is shortening in duration as the quantity of treasury bills increases. And if the collateral itself has a shorter duration, it means that there's less risk in the banking sector, there's less price sensitivity to changes in interest rates, versus if there were longer duration instruments in the banking sector. And so when we think about duration being a measure of risk, what we're talking about is how much a bank's balance sheet will change in value as rates go up and down. And if the Treasury and the US government decides to continue $1 to $2 trillion in fiscal deficits every year, the quantity of duration instruments will eventually have to rise. And in that way, I'm sure Michael Howell will forecast his liquidity index lower. But right now, he is forecasting it to go higher. So what is he expecting? He is expecting central bank balance sheet expansion. And what he sees here is that central banks are moving to start cutting rates all around the world, especially starting in Europe. He sees the Fed probably coming in to cut rates this year. He also sees the Fed moving to expand its balance sheet off of an announcement recently to shrink the size of QT. That is, the Fed's balance sheet currently is shrinking. In June, it'll start shrinking by less. And Howell's forecast, and it has been ours for a while, in that ample reserves framework, that the Fed's balance sheet will eventually have to start expanding. And as it starts expanding, what it does in his framework is it creates more collateral in the system that can be converted quickly to cash, which can then be spent on financial instruments. So this is an intense oversimplification of what Howell represents. Okay, he has decades of work. His book is really, it's so interesting to go through how many components to this framework there are, and I can't even begin to get into them in one video. We'll try to have Michael Howell back on to explain more about his liquidity framework. He also notes that Bitcoin responds really well to global liquidity and changes in global liquidity, and that is why we care about it too. We see Bitcoin as a financial asset now. And as a financial asset, it will be the recipient of funds that are created from an increase in global liquidity. So that's why global liquidity is so important to understand for Bitcoin. And when we think about Bitcoin's drivers, because right now, as we sit here towards the end of May, we're looking at central banks starting to move from tightening to easing policy. And that should, in theory, drive this global liquidity stock of collateral higher in quantity and in value. Thanks for sticking with us today at the Bitcoin Layer, and we'll catch you guys next time. The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by River. River.com/TBL for that special offer. And the reason that we love River at the Bitcoin Layer is that they put your education first. River.com/learn to understand what Bitcoin is, the fundamentals. Also, how to get your Bitcoin off the exchange into your own custody solution. You can use river.com/learn for all of that information. Go check them out today.